Good evening. It is my real pleasure this evening to call to order this meeting of the Planning Commission. It's also my last meeting as the chair, so this evening we have present Commissioners Carlson, Vice Chair Walter, Commissioners Morriso and Barksdale. Commissioner Lang is out on business. I think the first item we have is the agenda. Do we have a motion to approve the agenda?
So moved.
Do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion passes. We have the agenda. The first item is the City Council communications. I believe our mayor will be coming in later, so we'll defer that for now. Do we have any community council presentations or updates? If not, we'll keep moving on. Mr. Cullen, do we have any staff updates this evening?
Yes, sir. Before we begin, there's something that I'd like to do with Commissioner Carlson's assistance here.
A couple of presentations. We are very fortunate on the Planning Commission. Every one of our commissioners would make a fine chair or vice chair, or eventually both. And John Davidoff has been one of our best yet. Served with a great deal of distinction, asked questions that needed to be asked, and on one of the most contentious and one of the most difficult issues, the downtown livability, I really think steered a very skillful course through very perilous waters. So, John Davidoff, thank you very much for a stellar tenure as both vice chair and as chairman of the Bellevue Planning Commission.
Thank you, John.
And as is custom here on the Bellevue Planning Commission, our current vice chair will be stepping up to the role as the incoming chairman of the Planning Commission. Stephanie Walter is just a wonderful example of the kind of volunteer you want in a rulemaking, a body like the Planning Commission. She came here as a concerned citizen who thought that Bellevue needed to pay closer attention to the impact on neighbors and neighborhoods by current land use standards and codes. And that is what has resulted in her very successful tenure as a member, as a successful vice chair, and, starting with our next meeting, our new chair. So, Stephanie, if you could come and accept this expression of our gratitude and appreciation, the Bellevue Planning Commission.
Pause for a moment because we're going to get pictures.
More pictures.
Janet, would you mind?
Oh, well, I can take them on my phone.
You might as well get them on one.
All right.
Good for my camera.
Thank you.
I'll put on the light here. Just be patient.
Let's go over here by the
flags.
Record this for posterity.
How would you like this?
Yeah, just with you, right here with you. And actually, you know what?
Oh.
Yeah,
perfect.
Perfect.
That's great. One, two, three. Oh, I'm trying again. One, two, three. Good.
Can I take my glasses?
Yep. Please do.
Take it with our new iPad.
That's it.
IT approved.
One, two, three. Nice.
Okay, and I would like, don't sit down just yet, because I'm going to get a picture of you and John together.
Don't
you step out.
Okay.
And then I'll do one of John and John. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
There we go.
One, two, three. And one more time. One, two, three.
All right, and I want to get a picture of John and John. You are the grizzled veteran.
of the...
Sorry about that. Okay, 1, 2, 3. Again, 1, 2, 3.
Thank you very much. I've got a few other things.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you for indulging me, and congratulations. It'll be sad to see you go, but we've got excellent people stepping up. Stephanie Walter as the chair-elect, and Jeremy Barksdale, Commissioner Barksdale, as the vice-chair-elect. I think it's very important to record these moments. One of the planning commissions that I worked with was formed by act of the state legislature in 1959. So there's over 50 years of planning commission involvement in this particular community, and they didn't have that kind of archival record. We tend to think and forget that we want to leave something to remind the people that follow after us what came before us. So that's thank you for indulging me on all of that.
Thank you.
All right, then. The couple of things I wanted to report out to you here, just bear with me. I get it here. Your quarterly check-in. Chair Davidos and Vice Chair Walter and I met with the mayor on July the 7th and to discuss the Planning Commission progress and status for the second quarter, April 1st to June 30th. The packet includes all the numbers and details of what took that place during that quarter. I want to, because this is the last meeting of your year before you go on your summer break, is we just reflect briefly on the past year, because it has been quite an accomplished year for the Planning Commission. You have worked very hard at what you did. A year ago at this time, you were transmitting the Eastgate Land Use Code Amendment recommendations to City Council. And notwithstanding some of the bumps in the road with that particular code amendment package, it was still an act, it was still fine work, and you had put so much effort into that. And you may not recall, but you actually did the low-impact development standards, too. And you adopted those in September. You had a slate of plan amendments that you held public hearings on for final review in October. And then you had a really good retreat in November. And we're still following up with things from that retreat. But perhaps the real landmark of the past year, as Commissioner Carlson had pointed out, was the downtown livability. You were asked if you could get, you were tasked, actually, to get it done by the end of May, and you delivered. And so I'm really proud of you for doing that. You put the time and the effort, and you did what it took to get that recommendation to the finish line. So I really appreciate that. And that was no small effort. That last push was 5 complete months of downtown livability. We took one break for plan amendments. And then you wrapped up in June. You had that huge public hearing. And I think there was about 125 people in the combined two rooms here. And that was a very contentious plan amendment. And so I just want to reflect, because we tend to forget all the things that we've done over the past year, but you have done a lot. And under the leadership of your chairman, Commissioner Davidos, and your vice chair, Commissioner Walter, it has been a successful year. So I'm looking forward to, I'm proud to be your staff liaison. I am looking forward to another continued year of success. And with that's the quarterly check-in part of my staff report. I want to talk a little bit about the upcoming schedule. It is we're looking at September, October, and November and December, generally speaking. It is quieter than usual at the moment. You never know what's going to be given to the Planning Commission to review. So I'm going to take advantage of that, because there's follow-up things from the retreat last year that we never had the opportunity to get to. And one of those is the guiding principles. So I'm looking forward to our first meeting in September 13th having that discussion on guiding principles. And it may take more than one meeting, but I think it's going to give us a good start. Now, and then along with that are the bylaws.
Now, the city attorney's office is asked if we could get those bylaws done by the end of September for them. And I said I'd bring it to the planning commission. I think we can deliver that. You got an introduction to them on July the 10th, mm-hmm. and you are, or the July the 12th, excuse me, and you are going to have a meeting on September 13th where we'll be discussing the bylaws, and you'll be hearing more from the city attorney's office and follow up to some of the questions you had. And September 27th, it'll give you opportunity for yet a little bit more discussion and taking action on those bylaws. So that's what we're looking at primarily in September with, one other item is plan amendments. We got a couple of plan amendments that are heading into final review. September 27th, you're going to get a briefing on them. And following up in the spirit of what we had agreed upon at the retreat, if you require any information to help inform your decision leading into the public hearing at the end of October, that will be the time to do it. In October, you'll have the public hearing, and I'll probably be making a recommendation to City Council, if not at that meeting, at the first meeting in November. And in November, we're going to have your retreat. That'll be your annual retreat. It's Wednesday, November the 15th. Please save the date. I'm going to send something out on your calendar shortly. All right, that's the upcoming calendar. A couple of other items related to working with our new digital devices here.
I have a question about the upcoming schedule.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we've talked about is the comprehensive plan amendment process. Can we discuss it during this open period?
Okay. Is that the pleasure of the board?
Yeah, I actually would like to,
sure,
to piggyback on that. I think we had pretty strong consensus that we needed it as an agenda item of its own, allotted at least a half an hour, because I think there were some good thoughts in the room about what comes first, the chicken or the egg, and I'd really like to see us take this since we have a lull, just take the opportunity to get something in place that is a little more up to date.
All right, I'll schedule something. I don't know exactly what date we'll put it on, but I will schedule something. All right then. Okay, let's see here. One of the notices I sent out, it's very, very important, is that your iPad operating system needs to be updated. There's a security patch. And if you're unsure how to do it, I sent out an email that had some instructions. If you're unsure how to do it, please see me at the end of the meeting and I will help you do it. But it has to be done by July the 28th, or the IT department's going to be hounding you to get it done.
That was a really heavy-handed email.
Yeah, well, apparently there's some significant security risks out there, and it could really compromise, and we just don't want that.
Yeah, we don't want the Russians.
Because what we do is really important, and they're going to want to know.
Normally you wouldn't get a new device, and that would be the first thing that you'd be asked to do is update it, but in this case, that's the requirement there. So please, if you need some help, see me after the meeting. Let's see, desk packet correspondence. Eventually that, like your Planning Commission packets in the upcoming months, will be switched to an all-digital format, and the packet that is sitting in front of you will become obsolete. So, I do realize that Commissioner Carlson's hoping this will be rolled out over 18 months. We may accelerate it a little. You mentioned that
yes.
At the last meeting.
But I moved to an accelerated timetable. I think within 13 and a half months, we should be ready to go.
Sounds like a plan, Commissioner Carlson.
Now, I've been sending your email at the moment to both your personal email addresses, that's what we've traditionally done, and to your new city email addresses. Very soon, I'm going to be switching off your personal email addresses. So it will be incumbent upon you to be checking your email with your city email address.
Can you send us a notice when you stop using our personal email addresses?
Yes. Yes. I was hoping Commissioner Lang would be here tonight so I could get him his iPad. He has not received his yet because he missed last meeting. But once he has it and he's up and running, we'll be in a position to do that. All right, then. And I think that concludes my report out. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cullen. And thank you, Commissioner Carlson and Mr. Cullen, for your kind words. Really appreciate the gesture. I also want to say the work is a reflection of the commission as a whole. It's been a long year, challenging year. Also want to acknowledge, Mr. Cullen, your efforts. I want to say that I could not have fulfilled my role as the chair without the very strong support and partnership you gave me. So thank you.
Thank you.
So moving on, the next up is public comment. I believe we have nobody signed up for public comment. However, if there is somebody here who would like to use the time, please, if you would raise your hands. If not, we'll keep moving on. The first item on the agenda is the Grand Connection Phase 1. So we'll give it back to you, Mr. Cullen, for some context. And Mr. Cullen, good evening.
Thank you. Both of your study sessions tonight are actually just informational items. I've asked Bradley Calvert, who is our community development manager in planning and community development here at the City of Bellevue and project manager for the Grand Connection, to give you a presentation on phase one of it. And just as an aside, Chair Davidos, I've given you, I think you have a copy of the old agenda format, which does include the times that we estimated for each one of the agenda items. So that concludes my intro remarks. And
thank you.
The floor back to over to you.
Good evening, Bradley.
Good evening.
It's over to you then.
Thank you, and thank you for having me here this evening. If you recall, I was here in mid-fall of last year, kind of giving an update where we were. We were kind of wrapping up the visioning process for Sequence 1 of the Grand Connection, which is the existing infrastructure from Maidenbauer Bay to essentially City Hall. Tonight, we wanted to talk about where we go from there, how that's been wrapped up into a framework plan that we will pursue adoption on, and I would also like to give some updates on the Interstate 405 crossings. That was something that we had some conceptual sketches when we came through last fall, but they have dramatically advanced since last time, so I'm going to show you where those are at and what those next steps are for the I-405 crossing. And then just a quick overview of where we are with the Wilburton commercial area. The Wilburton Grand Connection, it's two elements, but it's being built as one single project, so just where we are on that. Some of the emerging concepts and visions in those next steps as well. So kind of quick refresher on the route of the Grand Connection. The orange line that you see here is kind of the primary spine. It connects Maidenbauer Bay to Old Bellevue, the downtown park into the heart of downtown, crossing over I-405 at approximately Northeast 6th Street, and then ultimately interfacing with the future Wilburton commercial area and the East Side Rail Corridor. The blue line represents an alternative route for cyclists as well as alternative transportation options, which we will explore, that were part of the presentation last fall. Tonight, I won't go through all of the recommendations that came out from Sequence 1. Rather, I'll explain how that's been wrapped up in this report and where you can get that information from and how to review that. But the body of work is broken into two sequences. The second was the I-405 crossing, which we'll cover in just a bit. And then the actual layering of the visioning process was approached from first defining the route. The graphic that I had just shown you, that's the recommended route for the Grand Connection. But early on, we just kind of had a conceptual diagram of how that would work. So the first step was to identify the route, then identify the identity of the route. What is that overarching concept that ties the whole thing together? The cohesive design strategies, which are the smaller elements that we had talked about at the last meeting, focused on paving, weather protection, art and culture, vegetation, things like that. They kind of stitch everything together, the smaller elements. And then lastly, the major public space improvements. And last time we met, we spoke about the entrance to Downtown Park, Compass Plaza, Bellevue Transit Center, and then the I-405 crossing element itself is considered a major public space improvement. So just kind of where we've been, those top row of sketches is kind of where we started, just quick concepts and some sketch paper, and then we evolved into the graphics that you see below that we brought last fall. Left to right is the concept for the reimagined Compass Plaza, the entrance to Northeast the northeast corner of the downtown park, and then this concept of alternative transportation options as well with the autonomous shuttles. But all of that work has been put together into what we're calling the Grand Connection Framework Plan. And this is all of the recommendations consolidated for the segment from Maidenbauer Bay to City Hall, or what we're calling the Civic Center District. And you can see kind of how that the document is structured. It's in 11 total chapters. It's downloadable via that link, the first one that you see there, on the project website at BellevueGrandConnection.com. We did break the document out into sections, so you do not have to download all 200 pages and read them all at once. With your new iPads, you can download each individual chapter and read the ones that you find most interesting to yourself as well. You'll see that there is a chapter for art and culture there, and I'll talk about this in just a minute. We actually pursued that as a sort of an appendix to this overarching framework plan, a cohesive design strategy in some way. But one of the key goals of the Grand Connection was to really turn that into a kind of a cultural corridor. So we brought in a sub-consultant, an artist team, to look at that and make some recommendations. But you will see that embedded in this document. You will see some graphics for the Interstate I-405 crossing in this, but that's not for adoption purposes, ultimately, for this body of the work. It's really just for context. The way the document is structured is using Compass Plaza, the recommendation there is an example, is you have the background information, kind of existing conditions, looking at the recommendations and why those recommendations were made, kind of that key graphic that really shows the overarching change, and then integrating part of the art and culture plan into this document. Though it is an appendix, we didn't want this to kind of get lost in the shuffle. Art and culture is to be a very essential element to the Grand Connection, a very important element, so we wanted to make sure that a large majority of that was brought along with this framework plan. So we lay out the vision, the objectives, and then what are those moves to advance art and culture as part of the route. And then we also identify the next steps. In some cases, it requires design refinement. In other cases, it's further defining what the funding may be to improve that, what the partnerships, the collaboration may be. So it's just kind of an example of how the document is laid out. We have released this to the public, and we've gone around to the boards and commissions to essentially notify everyone that this is out there. We're taking public comments all the way through September. The goal is to go back and refine where necessary, or take any of these comments into consideration as we move forward into design refinements, and to take this plan to City Council in the fall for adoption for Phase 1, or Sequence 1, Maidenbauer Bay to City Hall. As I mentioned, art and culture is an essential element to this. It's to be a defining element. It's to be supportive of the cohesive design strategies. If we look back at what we presented in the fall, that could come by way of the paving strategies. It could come by way of the weather protection. How do we incorporate art into the aesthetic quality of these smaller scale improvements? But it's also to speak to Bellevue's cultural diversity, our technology, environmental performance. An example we like to use is the Tillicum Bridge in Portland. It's a pedestrian, cyclist, and transit-only bridge, but it's illuminated at night. And the illumination on there actually reflects the performance of the river below. So the color changes based on the water temperature. The lights pulsate based on the speed of the river. The intensity of the light changes based on the actual water levels of the river. So looking at art from that kind of lens, how can we use it as something that's educational or reflective of the local environment, local culture, things like that. So that's actually an appendix plan that we released shortly after the framework plan that you can also find on the project website under the Art on the Grand Connection tab. So that's also open for public comment and review.
If I could ask a question.
Yes.
So in the previous slide, I like that you showcase a few things and you speak to those four bullets.
Mm-hmm.
Do we also emphasize the history of Bellevue?
Yes.
And the heritage?
Yes, we have, actually in the appendix it probably speaks a little more to that than it does in the actual framework plan, but some of the strategies around downtown park, acknowledging the school that used to be there, acknowledging the agricultural history of Bellevue,
right.
So finding those opportunities to incorporate that.
Thank you.
So programming is another key element, and I bring this up because we're in the process of planning an event, but we have a lot of recommendations to create new public spaces and enhance public spaces along the Grand Connection route, but how do we get people to go there? And the main reason why I bring that up is that when we did our interviews and we did our public engagement, when we did our giant map, if you recall that out in the concourse of City Hall, people tabbed that with kind of what they wanted to see along the route. And most of those comments were related to programming versus the interviews we did in person with people actually in Compass Plaza in the downtown park, and they wanted physical changes. They wanted more seating, more weather protection. So essentially the line was people being interviewed wanted reasons to stay. People that submitted comments wanted reasons to go there. And we saw that as an opportunity for programming. So you'll see that as a chapter in the framework plan, but we want to find ways to activate public spaces, how can we inspire our community, engage local businesses and residents, and to also showcase the innovation, technology, and creativity of Bellevue. So what you're seeing there is a giant 20-foot diameter game of Simon. If you're familiar with that game, it was released in the 70s, and it's this concept you have to memorize the color sequence that it gives you. It's a one-person game, essentially. But we had this conversation about how we could incorporate gaming and technology in this program, and we started meeting with local businesses and local companies, and we came up with this concept of essentially a giant version of this. This would actually set a Guinness Book of World Record for the largest game of Simon ever played. And actually fabricate one of these and incorporate this with other elements of technology and bring residents out, bring the people that work in Bellevue out, bring visitors to Bellevue to engage in our public spaces in a new way. And to use this as kind of a catalyst for future events that really showcase the creativity and the technology that is coming out of Bellevue. This event is scheduled for September 28th and 29th. We hope that you will all be there. The game is actually designed, if you recall the way I was describing Simon, it's actually an individual player game, but this will be played by, takes approximately 8 to 10 people to press one of those. So it's an idea of social gathering, social cohesion. If you are trying to remember these colors, you and 7 other people have to remember them as well and make sure that you all go in the same direction. So really trying to activate this space in a new way and to just kind of bring people together. So keep an eye out for that. We actually just launched a page on the project website for that as well. So we're going to be giving updates on this thing actually being built. So the actual coding is being done by a 17-year-old boy, his son from one of the companies that we're working with. And the steel fabrication is being done by a local 17-year-old girl who is working with one of the designers of this. So that idea of bringing more of the community in. Everything from fabricating to launching.
What's the price tag for that?
Right now we're doing volunteer labor on this, and we are pursuing sponsorships with several organizations. Part of the game will be done as a tournament style, so local companies will sign up and contribute. Cool. We're really trying to make this a community-driven event, community-driven.
What's the budget for it?
The total, I think what we're allocating to it is about $25,000. There's more elements to this event. It's not just for this. So, but part of the Grand Connection budget for this year and next allocated that dollar amount for programming elements, similar to, if you remember, the ERC event that we threw last November, where we turned that into a kind of a small cafe, show people what that rail line would be like with people on it. It's kind of in that spirit.
Those colors, they look like awfully like Google's colors. I hope they're sponsoring us.
Simon, actually, they were out in front of them by about 30 or 40 years. We've actually reached out to Hasbro to see if they're interested in this, since we will be setting. We actually have a meeting scheduled with them later this week to discuss how they may also participate in this. So.
How are we advertising it? Yeah, but
A lot of different ways. We're actually putting that strategy together now. We'll do a hard launch on the kind of campaign in August. We're still getting everything else around it, and we have testing for this next week. So,
cool.
So
Facebook ads or Facebook?
Facebook, pages, project website, city website, yeah. Our email subscribers, local businesses as well. We've already begun to reach out to them about forming teams. You can actually sign up on the website now to kind of hold a spot for one of the teams. And then there will also just be open time as well so that residents can come out and just basically jump on and start playing.
Yeah. I think make sure we hit social media pretty heavily will be key.
Yep. And we'll be broadcasting that out to all the boards, commissions, committees, things like that. So hopefully we can help get a push on that. But cool. It's already generated a lot of excitement, so it's been good.
Sweet.
So the Interstate 405 crossing, which is that big piece connecting Wilburton and connecting the downtown. Some of the goals for that were to create a safe and comfortable connection for pedestrians and cyclists, look for opportunities for public space, how can we integrate this with future developments in the future Woolwich and Commercial area and the East Side Rail Corridor, so a lot of opportunities to interface with those, and then looking for a signature form and design as well as experience through these. So the consultant has identified three alternatives for us. We have looked at, let's see, actually this doesn't show up there. Basically between 6th and 4th is where we've identified the crossing can happen or where it should happen. We own the Lincoln Center property, so that makes it a little easier for us to try to interface into the Woolwich and Commercial area. The images, the way this is set up, the three alternatives, the images that you'll see on the left, this is where we were, where we were in fall of 2016. The ones on the right are where we were in March of 2017, and the following images will be kind of our 90% design phase. This is what will be incorporated into the Wilburton CEPA process. So this first one is really looking at this kind of sculptural serpentine bridge, looking for new technology, new materials to incorporate into here, not just standard concrete and steel. And this is where we are today. And this is a little bit washed out, but the next graphic will probably show it better. But this sculptural bridge that emerges off of Northeast 6th from out underneath the light rail line and lands in a public space that Lincoln Center could be used for. There's kind of a grand descent staircase, the part that's a little bit washed out there, but it also remains elevated across 116th to the ERC. This area is actually kind of in a fishbowl, so it's below the East Side Rail Corridor. So we wanted to make sure that we could get people down to street level, but also over to the ERC. That provides us with north, south, east, west connectivity for pedestrians and cyclists. So if you were hovering over Interstate 405,
what is where you see the pedestrians congregating?
Do we have a laser pointer?
Isn't that where the homeless shelter is now?
That is the Lincoln Center site, yes. That is the northeast side of it. That's actually where the parking lot entrance is to the current site.
Okay.
Thank you. Maybe this will help out a little bit.
And so is that the Ford dealership to
Ford will be down
south? South? Okay.
Yeah. A little bit onto the page, mainly off of it there. But you can see a serpentine structure coming across. Right here would be this kind of grand staircase that would descend and then coming elevated across to the ERC. So if you're essentially hovering over this point, actually right about here, this is what you would see. This is looking east. So you can see that kind of grand stair in the background landing in a public space. Structure continues on. Opportunities for viewing platforms, to say Mount Rainier. This one explores opportunities of using cross-laminated timber for construction, for sustainability, as well as kind of a signature form and design. That's where we get this layering of material from. In the background here, you could actually have gaps between it where you could install lights, and this could become a glowing sculptural object in the Wilburton Commercial area, sort of a beacon. So this is the first of three options. The second was a little more on the utilitarian side, I guess, a more direct connection. We started with something a little more serpentine, but that first alternative ended up kind of taking that on. This looked at something a little simpler, but trying to embrace or have the buildings embrace that, so build around it, similar to the High Line, so you could access buildings directly off of this connection. You can see the routes coming off of 6th and 4th that would lead to a small pocket of public space here and then come straight across to the ERC, again, landing in a more modest public space here. Both of these options also would pursue daylighting the existing creek that runs through here and making that into an asset. So if you were standing right here on the west side of the interstate, this is what you would see. Pocket of public space here, but a very much more direct connection here, but using vegetation to screen from the sights and the sounds of the interstate and to make that crossing a little more comfortable. The blue line here represents the bike lane as well as potential alternative transportation options. The third option was much larger in scale, looking at how much of the interstate could be covered between Northeast 4th and Northeast 6th. So when we started, we looked at, you know, can we barrel vault over these ramps entirely and increase that total surface area? Created a bit of a challenge. If you're standing at the center and this is zero elevation, that would be a 30-foot increase. Really becomes unusable space. Yeah. The pinch point becomes so small that you actually could not access this park from Northeast 4th. So the evolution of that started to see that peel back a bit, berm up on the sides next to the ramp so we could still screen from the interstate, create a sculpted form, a sculpted landscape, and maintain access from Northeast 4th. So the goal here was to make sure that this could be accessed from all sides, 4th, 6th, future private development on the west or the east sides of the interstate. And just some examples of that sculpted landscape. And this is where we are today. As you can see, the partial berms over the ramps, a central public space right here, another berm over the northeast 6th, and then an elevated kind of shortcut crossing that would also create a viewing platform to Mount Rainier. This is in comparable size to Clyde Warren Park in Dallas, Texas, just a little bit smaller. This is shorter and wider versus in Dallas where it's much more linear. You can see the entrance there, and despite the scale of this drawing, if you go and stand at Northeast 4th, you can see how large this public space would actually be. And the berms now, these hills, that as I mentioned before, the 0 to 30-foot elevation change, if this is 0, this is actually 12 feet. So these berms that we would be able to create would actually be usable and programmable. If you're standing right here at Northeast 4th, this is what you would see instead of the interstate, and you can see how we can program some of these berms, whether it be with vegetation or with clay hills. You see the plaza in the distance there, and then the elevated, the viewing observation deck as well to Northeast 4th. So that's where we are with the three alternatives. These are going to be incorporated into the Wilberton CEPA process. There are lots of other consequences to whichever one we choose, such as the Lincoln Center property being in play. Does that turn into a public space? Is it something else? So being able to factor in all those elements as part of the CEPA process to help us inform which of the three alternatives would be the best decision.
Are there any plans to get community feedback on these alternatives?
Yes, we are letting the framework plan sit out there for a little bit, let that settle in before we go out with another wave. But yes, we'll be doing open houses for this as well. This will be, as I said, will be incorporated in the CEPA process, but will also come out in a second draft or a second volume to the framework plan, so it'll have its own version as well. That CEPA process is expected to wrap up in January of 2018.
Cool.
So,
what impact would there be on vehicular traffic on 112th and 116th?
112th and from this crossing, none.
Okay. What if there are future plans to add an additional lane to 405?
That accommodates this. That would not preclude any of these crossings. That's been factored in.
Okay.
And then lastly, we'll just touch on the Wilberton commercial area where we are. Commissioner Barksdale here is our co-chair on our CAC. We're looking at this entire kind of 320-acre area. You can see the confluence of all the infrastructure that's going in there. We're 7 months into the CAC process, and some of what we have heard from the CAC as well as the public, we have launched one public survey. We have another one coming out shortly. Something different from downtown, that's generally speaking in character. The community-oriented business concepts, community theaters, arts district, tech startups, incubator space. Public space and open space have been defined by the public as the most important issue, and that includes trail-oriented development. This is a great opportunity to have a unique and defining feature to the study area, that ERC is a spine through the study area. So we've looked at public space and just some of the polls that we've gotten back from the CAC and the property owners and what they would prefer. Both have identified the ERC as a very important element, and then a little bit of a disparity on where that public space should go, over the interstate or in the study area.
What's the difference between the blue and the yellow?
The bluish green color here, that is the CAC responses, and the yellow are the property owners. We did the same thing with transportation, looking at what are the most important elements. So we gave some provocations of improving 116th, connections to the west, breaking up the blocks. And in this case, both the CAC and the property owners concluded that some opportunities to break up the blocks and enhance permeability was top priority. This image and then the next one here are just kind of general massings. In terms of density, we gave the CAC essentially a map and had them color in based off existing development patterns in Bellevue on where they thought intensity and density should go. In both cases, they really defined this area around the Grand Connection ERC as the greatest density and greatest intensity. You see the Wilberton Station up here. So both of these we're evaluating right now as part of the SEPA process and development potential and impacts to transportation.
Is that body of water Lake Bellevue?
Yes, this is okay. Lake Bellevue.
So you've got your hospitals and medical buildings off there to the immediate west of Lake Bellevue.
Medical district is right in there.
Okay.
And that area, despite what this graphic shows, has actually been defined as a no change for this planning horizon, so this hospital would remain the same. We actually have an updated graphic now that reflects that. We identified certain elements in here that wouldn't see a substantial change in terms of density.
So I have a question. It says Wilberton Commercial Area. Is that what it is now, or is it going to all be commercial and no housing go there?
That's what it is now.
Okay. So, and I apologize if I missed something, but is this going to include housing, mixed use,
absolutely,
affordable housing?
Affordable housing is actually defined as one of the council principles for this study initiative. We will actually be bringing that to the CAC in, I believe, the October meeting as part of the implementation section that we'll discuss. But that has been defined as a top priority.
So I saw the artist housing. I was pretty excited about that, the artist housing and workspace.
Mm-hmm. And the public has defined. We did a public survey a few months ago. I think we received about 500 or 600 responses, and affordable housing is one of the top rated responses as well.
So can I make a pitch here? Something that as we go to smaller living units, that there be large creative units for... A lot of people do different projects, home projects, metalwork and quilting and all those things that take a large amount of space, and we're sort of shrinking everything. And if there were community space that could be used for that, much like artist lofts and studios, but something for more amateur, I think that would be wonderful. And it's something, to my knowledge, they don't have it in Bellevue. They have one in Kirkland. And there's all kinds of classes and all kinds. So when you're thinking programming and getting people there, et cetera, et cetera, I think that would be a really good opportunity to not only incubate tech, but incubate people's creative side and imagination.
Absolutely. And community-oriented elements really emerge as an important piece, especially for the CAC as well, looking for those kind of smaller startup-based areas, community gathering spaces, so that could also parlay into plazas and parks as well. So, again, this is a super high level. We'll probably be returning sometime in the near future to give a little more in-depth as to what some of that nuance is, and especially as the vision begins to emerge. We'll be hosting a work session at the next CAC meeting that will help kind of define that a little bit better, but that's a great point.
I don't want to lose track of, I know I've mentioned it, but I've also heard other folks mention nightlife.
Mm-hmm.
As part of this.
Nightlife has not been lost in that.
Yeah.
What?
Nightlife. I don't know how many people you all have talked to, but a lot of people I've talked to have said Bellevue, the nightlife.
We don't have any?
We have some, but it's not.
We're all home watching our children. What are you talking about?
But when you look at the demographic data, there are a lot of...
Instead, we got younger and smaller houses.
Yeah, I've heard that from people who attend conferences.
Yeah.
They love Bellevue for the conferences, but there's
nothing.
The streets grow up at night.
Yeah.
Well, we've had that even after our meetings.
Yeah. I remember when Terry first started, and I took him up to City Center, and you looked down right after work at like 5 o'clock, 5:30, at the right in the open area, and there's no one really out. I mean, it's near the transit center.
So to kind of put some graphics to those massing blocks that we just looked at, we've looked at some relevant precedents with the CAC and some other ones that we'll be bringing, as well as part of a public survey that just launched today. But Atlantic Station in Atlanta, for kind of its diversity and density that it's included, as well as office and housing. The South Waterfront Eco District in Portland is kind of a ground-up new development. We are working with obviously a much cleaner slate than what you guys did with downtown livability. A lot of room for growth and opportunity, and also sustainability. The impact of a new park, Clyde Warren Park in Dallas, and what that did for the Arts Center District, Olympic Village in Vancouver for something a little more compact. But then also, how do we transition? Because we have single-family neighborhoods to the east, we have some to the south. How do we incorporate gentle density that begins to respect those neighborhoods and steps down? So the town center in Woodstock, Georgia, Gateway Village in Charlotte, North Carolina, and then Reston and Renton, Virginia. So how do we, respect the single-family neighborhoods that are there but still serve as a valuable asset and destination for them? So next steps on the Wilburton Commercial Area, we just launched this survey today. Please feel free to log in and check this out. It has questions regarding preferences to density and building type, public space and connectivity. This is the second survey that we've launched. We'll be releasing the draft EIS in September. From there, the CAC will be refining and selecting a preferred alternative, land use and transportation. Our next few meetings will be focused on urban design, open space, and character, as well as implementation. How do we bridge the gap between aspirational and pragmatic, and what can happen? What are the uses that are there, and how do we encourage the right kind of uses? One of the most important elements of this is to find its unique niche. It's to complement downtown and Bell Red and Spring District, not to compete. So what's missing between those two areas that this study area can satisfy?
And we have a couple of tactical urbanism projects that we're going to be doing as well.
Mm-hmm. So other than that, I will just open it up to any questions. As far as the framework plan, I will leave one physical copy here. If you have questions or if you'd like to sit down and have a one-on-one and talk about any of the strategies here, if you'd like to understand them a little more, please let me know. I'd be more than happy to do so. Otherwise, you can also submit comments via email or on the web. There's a comment form.
So I'll start. I have to ask you, so why bridge the pragmatic and the aspirational? Was that a CAC feedback, or was it a city council directive, or was it a staff recommendation?
Well, I think it's a language. How do we make the aspirational happen? How do we, we're going to shoot for the moon, but how do we make that happen? So there is a bridge between the two that we have to.
Yeah, and this could be very pedantic, but I would just say be aspirational. Mm-hmm. Let's figure out what we can do. Yeah. Because bridging the pragmatic and the aspirational, you end up with the boring.
Mm-hmm. And I will say that the committee and the property owners have both, it's kind of go big or go home kind of deal. So it's really how do we make that happen and accomplish those goals. So.
Thank you. Any other comments, questions?
Yeah, go ahead.
The area we're talking about used to be Bellevue's Auto Row, and now Bellevue has like four auto rows. And then it was seen as a potential location for a civic arena if Bellevue was going to make a major pitch for a basketball and hockey team. That was where one of the arena sites was. And then they threw in the towel on that when locations in Seattle and down in Renton seemed to make more sense. I like the vision here a lot. I mean, I live in Wilburton. I would love to see this. I love, the REI and the shops that are going, with the exception of the pot shop. They're there now. I think we have to be mindful of the fact that as a retail magnet, we see some challenges already, west of Bellevue Square. And we have another area with the Spring District that is supposed to be, mixed use. It is also supposed to be a retail and business and residential area. So I'd like to see this happen, but I also know that, with the challenges that have been faced by the Bravern and with what we have coming around the corner right now in Spring District, do you think that we might be unduly optimistic about the chances for, a vibrant retail entity landing right here?
I think this came up actually very early on in the CAC, and then we have a market study that looks at this as well, and it has very kind of tempered expectations for retail here. And one of the challenges for the CAC, and Commissioner Walter actually brought up a very good point with these community-oriented spaces, and what else could happen at street level that could activate it, still be a magnet for people, but it doesn't necessarily have to be retail. Are there community event spaces? Are there arts elements? In some streets, maybe they could have residential at street level to help activate. So that's going to be one of the big challenges for the CAC. We do own a piece of property there. which is great. That's a great asset to have, and how we leverage that as kind of the catalyst for change and the direction for the area will be key. Another topic that they'll be addressing.
And the only other thing, concern I have is if the bridge for the Grand Connection across 405 takes on an additional identity as a park, you know, as a area for people to spend a lot of time, we have to factor in the noise issue.
Mm-hmm.
Because 405 is noisy, and it's very hard to relax in a noisy place. And you need only go to a freeway park in Seattle to see, you know, what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've been to freeway park a couple of times. It's not an area I'm in any hurry to go back to because, on paper, what a great place to go to get away from it all, but doesn't really lend itself to that experience with all the freeway noise from I-5 and, you know, the convention center. So just food for thought, I guess.
And part of that vision process, we looked at precedents to try to learn from those, understanding that there were some challenges with freeway park for sure. And that's why we went back and looked at Clyde Warren in Dallas and then the Fish Street Crossing in Atlanta. Both were very successful in being able to mitigate sound and still create public space. And that's applicable whether we go with option one or option three. But making sure that, yeah, it has to be a comfortable place to be and cross.
Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Morrison, please.
In all the discussion and community engagement, have you reached out to the heritage centers in the area towards the arts and culture so we possibly could have rotating artwork,
mm-hmm.
not something permanent, but something that can be changed? And also, I know, for example, Eastside Heritage Center, we have a lot of, I'm a board member, mm-hmm. we have a lot of pieces that people can interact with. Have you had discussions with these entities to find out if there's something that can be done with this?
Our artist consultant interviewed key stakeholders in the area. I don't recall off the top of my head exactly everyone they interviewed, but it was a pretty comprehensive list. If you go through the art and culture plan, in fact, we look for a lot of opportunities to not just put static installations in. One of their main recommendations happened to be the Green Connections is constantly curatable, rotating art exhibitions, so new things could come in. We looked at, say, the Bellgate sculpture that's at Compass Plaza, mm-hmm. a static, large piece that is now faded to the background since then, and learning from that is that how can we bring things in that keep it fresh, keep it interesting, keep it engaging. So they did identify, and I'd have to look back at the document, but working with local organizations, local groups, whether that's bringing in new pieces or kind of creating pieces that reflect those groups.
Can I add? So when we were coming up with our tactical urbanism projects, one group actually suggested having the artwork that would rotate. And I think what we're going to end up doing is having them, I don't know, having some way of testing the type of artwork that people would like to see
mm-hmm.
during those projects, during those events, those tactical urbanism events. So those opportunities to get maybe engaged more directly with some of the centers like the Heritage Center.
Yeah,
early on.
That's great. I think the idea of testing to see what would be attractive to people. Also, bear in mind that people not aware of the history
mm-hmm.
of the area may not even know
yep.
what they mm-hmm. could be interested
yep.
into interacting with.
Mm-hmm.
The other question I had was a piggyback to Commissioner Carlson's question. Traffic is a nightmare. I'm driving on 405, heading to the airport today at 10 in the morning. I'm sitting in traffic. The option with the Grand Connection over the 405, have the engineers or designers, architect consider what if we want to put an elevated highway? Would that be in the way of that? I mean, he asked about adding extra lanes to 405.
Mm-hmm.
How would that affect if we wanted to have an elevated highway over 405?
That's not something that was really considered. They try to keep essentially projects that are like the widening of I-405, kind of on the docket, whether they're kind of far enough along in terms of design or funding into this visioning process. Mm. So there's probably a lot of different options that could happen there, but there's only so many that we could accommodate for.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So next up we have, I think it's our affordable housing update. So mm-hmm. over to you, Mr. Carter. Ms. Lewis.
Thank you.
What have I done?
Thank you.
Okay.
Watch this.
Oh. There we go.
Yes.
So is that the response?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. Appreciate the opportunity to come tonight and talk to you about the affordable housing strategy that Janet and I have been working on for about the last year and a half that Council finally approved on June 5th of this year. So the purpose of tonight is to give you an overview of that affordable housing strategy and a preview of some of the actions that could come before the Commission as we work on the implementation over the next 2 to 3 years. The okay. There we go. I love technology. So basically, an overview of what we're going to present tonight is pretty much why this was done, how it came together, what's in it, and then what's next. So the basis... Yes, sir.
I have to say, I like your PowerPoint templates. They're quite different from the rest of the staff team.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, back to you.
That's okay. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. So why we did this, there was existing policy direction in the comprehensive plan in the city's economic development strategy, as well as the council's list of priorities. They set a list of about 15 or so priorities a couple of years ago, and coming up with an affordable housing strategy was one of those. And they were very clear and very... precise in their direction to the staff that this is not a plan. They were not looking for some document that would sit on the shelf. They really wanted some specific actions that we as a city could take to start to address the issue of affordable housing in Bellevue, recognizing that this is not something that's unique to Bellevue or just Bellevue's issue. It's really a regional issue. But there are things that we can do at the local level, a lot of things that we have been doing at the local level, but how can we expand on that and do more? So we put together something that would be consistent with the comprehensive plan housing policies and our strategy. The council really had a focus in this on certain segments of the population that they wanted this to address. Low and moderate income workers in the city, because we're seeing more and more growth, not just in the tech sector, which is often good paying jobs, not always, but the majority of those, but a lot in the service sector as well. And those are a lot of the jobs that the earnings in that is not enough to be able to afford to live in Bellevue, either to purchase something or even to rent here. So that was one area that they talked about, as well as folks that are just entering the workforce, either students or recent graduates from college that are looking for, getting their first job and starting out to be able to, for them to be able to find a place to live in Bellevue. First-time home buyers. Seniors, especially those that are on fixed incomes, that is becoming more and more difficult for them to stay in the homes that they have in Bellevue. And then families who have children in the Bellevue School District, because that is one of the draws to Bellevue. A lot of people want to live here because they want their children to go to Bellevue schools, which have an excellent reputation. So we've got a few numbers to throw at you here. I mean, Janet's going to talk about the actions that are in the affordable housing strategy and some of the next steps on that. So I'll try not to hit you with too many of these numbers, but just to give you a sense of why we did this and why there's such a need for affordable housing in Bellevue. What this graphic shows is that we have a supply of housing. Let me use my pointer here. So the top line is the supply of housing. So we have three categories here, and AMI is area median income. That's based on the median family income for King County, and then how much people make in relation to that. So we have folks who make more than 80% of that. That's the lighter area here. The middle area is the 50 to 80% of that area median income, and then those that make less than 50% of area median income. So you can see in terms of Bellevue households, about 17% of the population in Bellevue, the households in Bellevue, make less than 50% of area median income. About 9% are in the 50 to 80% range, and then about three quarters in the over 80% range.
What is that, about 70 grand?
The median income, area median income for King County is 96,000.
96?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, it's King County.
For King
okay.
County, right. It's always based on the county area median income.
Okay.
I've actually got those numbers. So for an individual, excuse me, that's for a family of four. For an individual, it's about 67,000.
Just so that I can understand this, because they're all stacked like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the top is what we have, and the middle is what we need.
Correct. Yes.
Okay.
So you can see that, so we only have about 6% of our housing supply that is affordable to about 17% of the population, which means we have a deficit of about 6,000 units for the group that's in this category right here.
Okay, Mike, I'm sorry, but I'm not understanding that graph. So 17% make more than the area median income?
17% make less than half of the area median income. Or about 22,000 people in our population make less than half of what most people make.
And the 9%?
The 9% is the
between 50 to 80% of it.
Correct. Yeah. So this is the group that we're most focused on in terms of affordable housing. This is where we have the greatest need. And I say that even though it looks like we have a big supply for that 9%, but even at this, below the 50 to 80%, because there's so much upward pressure that there are people that are, that are pushed into this category that aren't necessarily able to afford this category. So that actually reduces the amount of housing that's available for people that can afford this range. So it just pushes everything down. And then we also look at the countywide need, because these are the people that live in Bellevue, but we have people that want to live in Bellevue, that work in Bellevue, or just want to live here because they want their kids in the schools here, that also cannot afford the housing. So if you look at the countywide, about a quarter of the population is below that. So you can see we've got an even greater deficit if we're looking at our share of the countywide need.
So the countywide includes Bellevue households?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So a little bit more about housing need and what we've been hearing and why this is so important. You heard Bradley talk about the surveys they've done for the Wilburton area and how high of importance people put on affordable housing for that area. What we have heard through the Human Services Needs Update that we do every couple of years, the latest survey that's just out in the last couple of months, 77% of the respondents, which includes residents, human service providers, and others that participate in that survey, rated affordable housing as the number one community problem. 4 years ago, only about half rated it as the number one problem. So it's become much more real to people. They either are experiencing those problems, or they know people who are having trouble finding or keeping affordable housing in Bellevue. It's also an economic issue for the city. In the business survey we did a couple of years ago, every business sector that was surveyed rated Bellevue low on affordable housing solutions. And in particular, the tourism and retail industry reported that they're really having difficulty recruiting and retaining employees because they can't afford to live here. Or they have to make too many tough choices about living here, or they're commuting a long distance. One of the things that we heard when we did our kickoff to this, we had an educational forum. And one of the speakers was the executive director for human resources for the Bellevue School District. And one of the statistics that he threw out that has always stuck with me is when they recruit first-year teachers, they They come and they stay for about a year, and they lose about a quarter of those teachers every year. And a lot of it is because they can't afford to live in Bellevue. They make about $48,000 a year starting out. So they live in Covington or Kent or somewhere farther south. And they do that commute for a year and then decide they just can't do that anymore, and they end up going to work for one of the school districts in South County. So that's a huge turnover to have to deal with every year. Mm-hmm. And there's a cost to that.
Just out of curiosity, yeah, not to take away from this at all, mm-hmm, have we also looked at salaries? I'm just curious. How do our salaries for the school district compare to salaries to other school districts?
Oh, for the school district?
Yeah.
We haven't looked at that specifically, but I think, yeah, you know, Bellevue probably pays. They're pretty competitive, I'm sure. In that.
Okay.
But I don't know specifically what how it rates in some of the other districts.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about?
Oh, no. That's what I was saying. It wasn't to diminish.
But many of the private school teachers earn, if you look at total benefits, about a third less.
Yeah.
So it's tough. I'll tell you something. If you have, let's say, a job that pays $60,000 a year,
yeah,
and you have an apartment with, you know, your rent was $1,100, then it jumped to $1,300, mm-hmm, then it jumped to $1,650. It is getting increasingly difficult,
yep,
to have a one-bedroom apartment. You know, I've seen this, you know, with a lot of not just young workers, but, you know, older workers as well, whose jobs level off in salary, but the rising cost of housing, and that's why a lot of landlords have switched to month,
mm-hmm,
because the market is accelerating so rapidly. So, you know, this, even for people with decent jobs, this has become a real problem.
Oh, for sure. As I mentioned before, I made ask the question. It was more out of curiosity, not to diminish from the need.
Sure.
To your point about increasing rent, are we also looking at ways to, I don't know, where we are with, like, rent control and things like that?
Rent control is not legal in Washington State.
Yeah, can't do it. Back in the 80s, the legislature passed a law that forbids counties or cities from imposing rent controls.
Hmm.
Seattle came this close to passing an initiative to enact rent control in 1979, and in the early 80s, the legislature responded by outlawing rent control. They did the same thing on an income tax, but that's still not holding them back in Seattle from trying. But, again, several statutes were passed to limit the latitude,
mm-hmm,
of cities and counties to do these kinds of things.
And one of the things that we found through this process is that there are a limited number of tools that are available to,
yes,
local government in particular.
That's what I was, trying to get a sense of, like,
yep,
in addition to this, what other things can we do?
Like, right. Every tool has side effects. I mean, rent control really,
yes,
has side effects as well.
Sure.
Right.
It has consequences, you know, unintended as well.
There are some good aspects to it, but, yes, there are some negative consequences or implications to it as well.
Yeah.
So the other thing that we've looked at is in terms of how much people pay of their income for housing, and that includes whether it's rent or mortgage payment as well as their utilities. So what does it cost them to live in Bellevue relative to their income? And the reason we do this is that when nationally the way this is calculated is it's assumed that you can afford up to about 30% of your gross income for housing costs. If you're paying more than 30%, then what the statistics show is that people are then starting to have to make difficult choices.
Mm-hmm.
They're either not able to afford childcare or transportation or, you know, some of the you know, nutritious food, those types of things. So 30% is considered cost burdened, is the official term for that. So we've got about a third of all of our households that spend more than 30% of their income on housing. Even more dramatic is that we have 16% of all of our renters and about a third of our senior renters that spend more than 50%. So they're spending more than half of their income on housing. And what that means is they're making some very difficult choices that have to do with maybe medications or medical care or just the type of housing that they're living in, if they can even find something that, you know, they can afford to stay there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a real serious problem for seniors, and that comes into play in one of the actions that we're looking at a little bit later on. So that's they're termed to be severely cost burdened at that point. So, you know, Bellevue has a reputation of being a very well-to-do community, and we certainly have areas that are, but this really highlights just how challenging it is for a lot of people that live in Bellevue. And again, these are just the folks that live here.
So, Michael, based on discharge, what's the definition of very low income, moderate income?
So that gets back to that area median income that we talked about. So low income, and Janet, correct me if I'm wrong on this. So low income is anything under 50%. Very low income is under 30% of area median income. And I've got a slide coming up here that shows you what different folks earn. So minimum wage right now in Washington State is $11 an hour. That's about $23,000 a year, a little less than $23,000 a year. So if you look at this chart, this gives you an example of different occupations that we have, not just in Bellevue, but anywhere. You know, but these are folks working full-time jobs, maybe with or without benefits. Baristas, you know, everybody knows a barista. They make about $11 an hour in this example. So they're about minimum wage. If folks are, you know, a little less than $15 an hour, about $31,000 a year, and this gets at the point that Commissioner Carlson was making just a minute ago, they can afford, under that 30% of income, they can afford rents of a little less than $800 a month. And after that point, they're really spending more than they can afford on housing. Well, I don't know of anywhere you're going to find an apartment in Bellevue for $800 a month. There may be some, but I doubt that they come open very often. Likewise, workers at $20 an hour that are making $42,000 a year, they can afford about $1,000 a month rent. That's probably not likely to be very available in Bellevue either. I mean, we're seeing median rents in Bellevue, in parts of Bellevue, over $2,000 a month for just a basic one-bedroom apartment. And those are for some of the older units that are in town. So everybody's been reading about the rise in housing costs, and Commissioner Carlson mentioned this just a moment ago. I just read an article today, in fact, that the Seattle metropolitan area for the ninth month in a row was the highest percentage increase in housing of the major metropolitan areas in the country, over 13% increase over last year, same month last year, which is more than double the average of the other 20 metropolitan areas that are measured.
Yep.
And that's just continuing to go up. The median sales price for a single-family house now in Bellevue is over $1 million. I don't know who can afford those, but people are buying them. But that really pushes up the cost for everyone else. Likewise, the median rent, you can see there is over $2,700. So this is a serious situation. And again, it's not unique to Bellevue, but something that we're trying to figure out how we can try to address that. So how did we come up with this strategy? We had a set of guiding principles that the council developed and gave to us as we started this process. It was 11 guiding principles. It's in the report that you received electronically. It's on page 54, the numbered page 54 in that report. And that included things like recognizing the issue that we have, identifying those needs. So we started out doing a housing needs assessment, updating the information from the comprehensive plan to really look at what are the needs, where are those needs demographically. Focused on action, as I said, they didn't want a plan. They want to know what are some specific things that can be done. They said set ambitious goals. And we started out with a technical advisory group that set some pretty ambitious goals for trying to address this. Build on what we already have, because there are quite a few things that we do already as a city, individually as well as through a Regional Coalition for Housing, or ARCH. We're one of the charter members of that organization. It's been around about 25 years, and there are now 15 members of that. Draw upon knowledgeable resources. We did that by creating what we called our technical advisory group. Traditionally, we have done a citizen advisory committee, similar to what we're doing for Wilberton. This was such a specialized and technical area that we really felt we needed a little different approach to it. So we pulled together folks, 15 people, from different aspects of the housing industry, market rate housing developers, affordable housing developers and providers, human service providers, architects, legal advisors on funding, finance specialists, and I always, realtors, rental housing association. We really had a good cross-section of folks that understood all the different aspects mm-hmm. of the housing industry, both from the market side and on the affordable housing side. It was a really tremendous group, and we brought them together on a periodic basis as we had different things for them to provide some feedback to us and give us some guidance and review the analysis that we were doing on the different actions. So it was a very successful effort.
Was Hal Ferris one of those people?
Yes.
That's good. He former member here of the commission mm-hmm. and always someone very thoughtful when it came to suggestions and recommendations about housing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And Hal is a developer. He does okay. market rate housing. He also does some affordable housing. He's done some work with Bellevue College, for example, mm-hmm. In the housing that they're doing for the students. He's with Spectrum Development. So we used a lot of that expertise. As I mentioned earlier, we started out with an education forum, which is available online if you want to view the video. It's about 2 hours long. It went a half hour longer than we expected, but everybody stayed. We had over 75 people there, and we had five different speakers, and it was very informative, and I thought very useful. We did a lot of community outreach through the process. We had a couple of online open houses and surveys. We had what we called listening posts at a few areas in the city. We also held several stakeholder group meetings. We brought some folks in with different expertise or different interest in some of the areas, some of the different issues we were talking about. We used a lot of work that had been done in other places, like the HALA process in Seattle. They had identified a lot of potential actions. We were not recreating that process, but we also weren't trying to reinvent the wheel in terms of what are the things that could be done. So we developed a potential action list from all of those other sources, looking around the country at what other places are doing and what were available to us here. We used the TAG, the Technical Advisory Group, to kind of narrow that down, did some initial review of those to see what was realistic, what would probably work best in Bellevue based on their experience of working here and elsewhere. We took that to the council to get their blessing on it before we spent a lot of time analyzing. We wanted to make sure we weren't looking at something that they weren't going to consider later on. So we got that approval last September, and then we went heavily into the analysis of that, working with the TAG and other outside experts. We had consultants that were helping us through this process. And from that, we developed that technical analysis. These are some of the other, this is the list of folks that we had on the TAG. So we analyzed those potential actions. We had the TAG review and give us feedback on that. We tested a lot of things. We had some pro forma analysis that were done on different types of development that our consultants used. We had developers look at those assumptions to make sure we were using the right numbers, that this was realistic. Again, we got a lot of input from stakeholders and the general public, and we came up with a draft recommendation that we then took through the TAG and then out to the public, and that was earlier this spring. And then we took that to the council a couple of times. They gave some direction in terms of the fiscal aspect, you know, how much were they willing to contribute to the financial need for that. We identified different levels of funding that would get different amounts of affordable housing over time. This is meant to be a 10-year effort, and the council said we want to know what we can do over the next 2 to 3 years to generate additional affordable housing in the city over the next 10 years. So everything was geared toward that 10-year time frame, and we had anywhere from about 2,500 up to about 4,500 new housing units that would be affordable. We ended up at the 2,500 level right now, but the council is open to considering other things in the future. We're also going to be, and Janice can talk a little bit more about this, we'll be monitoring the effectiveness so that we know what's working and we can adjust as we go along.
That's good. Mm-hmm. Question. Please. This is something that has been in the back of my brain for a long time, and I think you both heard me ask the question in other arenas, but are we doing anything to inventory vacant houses?
Yes, we are actually looking into that to figure out how we can track that, because we've heard through the process, and you've brought it up, and others have brought it up. We're looking at utility bills. We're trying to figure out how we can really get a handle on it, because there's a lot of anecdotal information out there about foreign investors or folks that are just, you know, have like a second home or something that they're maintaining, but they're not really living there. We're still trying to figure out the best way to get a handle on that, and just to see how big of a problem it is.
Right. Let me. This subject is pretty near and dear to me, or not dear to me, but near to me. So within a mile of my house, there are three vacant houses, two of which are uninhabitable, as best as I can tell. The third one was uninhabitable and then turned into. I don't even know what you call it, but a squatters type of thing. Mm-hmm. There were gang tags on it. And I called code enforcement. Actually, the neighbors over there, somebody who showed me this house, mm-hmm. had called for years. And then I saw the back fence that butted up against, it doesn't matter, had boards broken. And there were mm-hmm. gang tags on the back. And so I finally called the police. And now, after that action, it's actually being remodeled and some life put into it. But what the neighborhood had to live with for X amount of time, and I know the broken window theory has gone very much out of vogue, which is unfortunate because I think it explains a lot, especially in older neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So there are two other houses by me that... I just think if there's that many by me, there's got to be more. Mm-hmm. And I think getting a handle on things like that through outreach from code enforcement or whoever mm-hmm. it would be to the different neighborhood groups would be really important and could augment what you're doing. Because you have two places that are empty that could have, I don't know, a Habitat for Humanity or just maybe it's, you know, one is just mm-hmm. a matter of clean up. The other one is uninhabitable because I had a big mm-hmm. explosion in it. Anyway, so and then there's the stories, and I know many people. I know it's anecdotal because the data hasn't been collected, so it can't be. But I think it's really important to know what we have in terms of houses that aren't being lived in or space that's being taken up that's not available for housing.
Yes, and that's why, because we've heard that so often, we are trying to find out just how widespread is that. You know, is there a lot of that vacancy that's happening that could be tapped into? Because other cities that have experienced that and have been able to identify those vacancies, I forget exactly how they do it, but there's some sort of a charge to the owners. You know, if it's not going to be lived in, then there's an additional charge that they have to pay, a tax of some kind. And I know Vancouver has done that. Different laws up there, so I don't know if we could do something like that. But first we want to get a handle on just how many units are we talking about. Is it a handful? Is it a couple of hundred? Is it, you know, a couple of thousand or more? So
I think you can find out really quickly through outreach to your different neighborhoods. And because all the neighbors know where they are.
Yep.
And what they say in Northtown is it's just sort of a ghost town, so that it impacts, first off, there's no community.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, the neighborhood businesses aren't being utilized because no one's living there. So it takes it to a bad level for something that's really expensive. It's working against yeah. what you all are trying to put together.
And then the next step in that is to figure out why they're not living there, because there are a lot of different reasons why they may be empty. So that gets a little bit more complicated, but we are working on that.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at utility bills in particular,
and thank
water
you for
usage
your indulgence.
To see,
mm-hmm.
yeah, because we do want to get a handle on that. So
you have a question, Commissioner Walters?
Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a follow-up to Commissioner Walters' point. So would you enlighten the commission to how far that conversation has gone? I'm in the real estate business, and I see, and I feel for the first-time home buyers, the low-income families, because you've got foreigners coming into the area and buying properties in cash and willing to pay.
Mm-hmm.
upward of 300,000 over asking. And if they're coming and living in the community, I mean, I'm all for diversity. I welcome that. But to Commissioner Walter's point, if we are losing the feel, the essence of the community, where some of our teachers can't even afford to live here at a cost to our children, I'd like to know how far that conversation has gone at the TAG level, not just we're going to research the data, but what are you considering? Let me find a better way to phrase that.
What can we do about it?
Right. What is what is TAG considering as options? Is this something that even has gone to council as a conversation that they've spoken about? How far has the conversation gone at this point?
So, sorry, I was just distracted by Commissioner Barstow.
The smell is just like, maybe that's why I had to think about it again.
And that's also a tough question.
Yeah. So just to clarify, the TAG's work is done. So they've disbanded. They've done their part of the work on this. But we did talk about that, and what we identified was we need to get a handle on this. We've been working with our IT and our demographer to figure out the best way that we can get a handle on that, and then we can figure out what, if anything, we can do about it. Hopefully there are some things that we can do about it if it is a significant issue. And we have raised this with the council, but there's nothing specific in here right now because we're still trying to figure out exactly how widespread that is. Now, you just gave me another idea, though. We could talk to, we had a representative from the Association of Realtors on the TAG. We could find out if there's anything, any tracking that's done through the realtors.
Yeah.
Who's buying and whether they're occupying those homes. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but that may be something else that we can pursue. And picking up on Commissioner Walter's suggestion, I think, and I'll have to talk to our legal department, I know if there are privacy issues with this, but get some sort of a website up that people can self-report, vacancies in their neighborhood, and then maybe we can verify that against utility bills or something like that. So there are some different things that we can do. It hasn't, I'll be honest with you, we've been focusing on some other things, so we haven't put as much effort into that so far, but we also haven't forgotten about it, and we are working on it. So we can, we can look at beefing up our efforts on that to get a better handle on it sooner.
Yeah, because I can tell you, I struggle with it as a realtor and as a civic leader. It's a major struggle for me. Just the idea of losing our sense of community, just to me that's unacceptable. And if we're looking at solving the issue of affordable housing, we need to consider this as we're looking at this. It's not something that needs to be done under vacuum, because I think that's also contributing to the price of housing escalating to the point that people cannot afford to buy in this area. So it's something that we need to look at now and not say, oh, we'll look at it later.
We're looking at a lot of these things right now. And back to the point here, one of the things that we learned through this, is, and the TAG was very clear as well, is that there is no single answer to this. There's no one cause. There's no one solution. So we have to look at a broad range of things, and we are doing that. A couple of the other things that we heard from the TAG that were very, very important, and this is direction that went to the council from the TAG as well, is that nibbling around the edges is not enough. It's really going to take some pretty bold action. And there's a list of the actions on page 4 of the document that we sent you. And you'll notice there's a couple of symbols out to the left. One's a dollar sign saying that there's additional money resources that are going to have to go with this particular action. And there's also another one that's supposed to look like a few little houses, but doesn't always look like that, that are saying, these are the bold actions that the TAG has identified as really needing some serious consideration by the council.
Was there one of those bullet point items to be like legislative actions? Because we may have to pass law in order to start seeing solution to the problem, just like Vancouver passed this 15% foreign buyer tax.
Yes, there are several legislative actions in this. Yeah, and Janet's going to go through those in just a minute.
Okay. If I could just go on my soapbox for a bit, I think that it's a deeper issue, because to me, we are attempting to fix the symptoms. And I would go so far as to say, look, if it's a free market and a certain country citizens can buy property in this country, then we should have the same privileges to buy property back in the other country. And I think what we have right now is a very skewed, lopsided free market. Mm. And unless we go after the root causes, fixing symptoms isn't really going to help us. Mm-hmm. And so I believe this goes back to the federal government. It has to go back to the president and obviously foreign policy. That's my soapbox here. But this is something I'm actually very disappointed. I mean, I'm a big free market believer, but free markets means on both sides. Mm-hmm. It can't be one-sided. And currently what we have is a very lopsided one-way free market. Mm-hmm. And unless we fix it, or at least do something about it, you know, we can fix the symptoms, but you know, we'll keep losing property to foreign citizens, and we will not have the same privileges back in return. So anyway, that's my soapbox.
An interesting side point to that is there is a lot of cities around the world experiencing this. It's this phenomenon of Chinese investment going out. And in London and in the most unusual places in Canada, towns that I know personally, wondering why anyone would invest there, mm-hmm. they're buying up houses. Yeah. So it's we're not an isolated case.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. One of the reasons, maybe you covered this when I was going back for seconds there. one of the reasons there's this housing boom with foreign investment, mm-hmm. primarily from China, in the Puget Sound area, is Vancouver, B.C., mm-hmm. Was the prize location for a lot of foreign investment, and they levied a fee on basically a tariff.
It's a 15% tax.
15% tax, yeah. And as a consequence, the money just came south. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you just an anecdote, you know, that backs up what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. We have a condo that is just 400 feet from the back of Bellevue Square, and we decided to, you know, put it up for sale to see what the interest was. Within 48 hours, there were 20 interested buyers. 18 of them were Asian buyers, many of them from abroad. Mm-hmm. Because they're looking to park their money where they're going to get a handsome rate of return. Mm-hmm. And Bellevue residential real estate is, you know, it's better than the stock market. It's better than precious metals. It's better than a lot of other speculation.
And it's just only sustainable if more of that money continues to come. Right, so they're banking anyway.
Well, just so the commission knows, the money will keep coming because half of the Chinese millionaires are thinking of investing overseas because they fear devaluation of their money. Mm-hmm. And the second nation that they want to invest is the United States. It's their second most popular, and Seattle is number two of the cities where they're looking to come and invest in real estate. Mm-hmm. So it's just going to keep coming in unless we take measures. As I said, I don't mind them coming in as long as they come and become a member of the community and make us a rich community. When it's at a cost to the community, then we need to have the conversation, a deeper conversation about
and
it.
And getting back to one of your earlier points about having legislative tools to address mm-hmm. that. So King County has recently formed what they call the King County Regional Affordable Housing Task Force. Mm-hmm. Mayor Stokes serves on that, representing Stone City Association. And Janet and I serve on the staff working group for that. But to the extent that I suspect that if it's an issue in Bellevue, and I suspect that it is, that it's also an issue in other cities in this region. So that's something that I think we can try to address more through that group as well. Because if we are going to need state legislation, we're going to need a lot of folks in Olympia lobbying for that to get that change and to get the kinds of tools. Because everything I've read so far is I don't think we have the authority in this state, or at least at the local level, to levy a type of tax like they did in Vancouver on foreign investment or vacant housing or something like that. So those are all the kinds of things that we're looking at. You know, this is a very complicated issue.
Certainly,
a lot of pieces to it, mm-hmm. and
I know I've learned a lot through this process and still learning a lot. But we also know that it's going to take a concerted effort. You know, this is not a one-shot deal. There's no silver bullet. This is going to take a sustained effort over time with some really dedicated resources to really address it. So, and that was one of the other things that came out of the tag. See how I just brought us right back to that?
Yeah.
Thank you. So, I'm going to ask Janet's now going to kind of walk us through the five strategies and the actions that go with those. These are all the ones that the council approved back in June, and we're now working on the implementation program for that, and Janet's heading up that effort, and she's going to talk about some of the implementation that we're doing that's particular to the Planning Commission as well.
Okay, thank you. So the affordable housing strategy that was approved by council last month is actually five strategies that are interrelated, and each strategy has a set of actions that are related to them. And each strategy is addressing a certain aspect of the complex affordable housing problem. The first strategy, help people stay in affordable housing, I think it's really important to have this one up front because of council's focus on, you know, focusing on the issues of the existing residents who are struggling with housing issues. And there's about, you know, two forks to this. The first one, A1, work with partners to acquire and preserve existing affordable housing. That has always been a priority for our funding, is to acquire the more affordable housing by nonprofits and housing authority and keep that affordable housing in our housing stock. So we'll be working with partners like the housing authority to continue that effort, and given the funding, you know, if we can bring more funds to this issue, you know, to increase that effort. And the other fork to this is to help people who are struggling with the housing costs in the housing that they own already. So, for example, expanding our home repair and weatherization programs and our utility and tax relief programs. And I should figure out how this works.
Can I ask a quick question while you do that?
Yes.
The state capital budget, I heard Representative, starts with K,
Gooderer, Patty Gooderer.
Yeah, talked to council on Monday, and she said that somehow the $1.5 million for Horizon Village from the state.
Highland Village.
What did I say?
Horizon.
I meant Highland. Thank you. In my head, that's what I said. But it fell through. So is that?
It's on hold.
It's on hold. Okay. So does the whole project go on hold, or is there an alternate funding source?
No. I think that, I mean, my sense is that the monies will come through, and we don't need it to close. The Housing Authority can take these funds, you know, when they become available.
Okay, so that didn't go away.
So it did not go away.
No. Wow, why do I want to say Horizon? Highland.
But it's a good point. I'll look into that because that's a concern. So the second strategy, create a variety of housing choices. You can see that I've got a couple that are highlighted here. And as we go through these strategies, the highlighted ones are the ones that you might see over the course of the next 2 to 3 years of implementation that involve Planning Commission changes and recommendations, such as policy changes and rezones. So let's see. Create a variety of housing choices. The Bellevue is becoming a more diverse community. We need more diverse housing types, especially a bigger range of affordabilities to serve our population and our households. The two that I have highlighted here as more diverse housing types are two types of housings that the market could produce without public subsidy that would reach more affordable levels. But unfortunately, of course, these are not without controversy. Both of these types of housing, micro apartments around light rail stations and detached ADUs. With the micro apartments, we would be looking for certain places, identifying areas in the town, in the city, where they might become appropriate, mostly in walkable neighborhoods, near transit, near services and jobs, and then looking at code changes that might encourage that kind of development. One thing we've heard is lowering parking requirements. It's always an important issue when you're talking about making housing more affordability. For the accessory dwelling units in neighborhoods, we already allow attached, if the accessory unit's within the building, within the single-family home. This would be looking at detached or backyard cottages. And the way we would approach that, of course, very cautious.
Mother-in-law apartment.
And the way we would approach that is through our neighborhood planning efforts that are going to come up. So we would look at this issue, we would talk with the community on this issue, neighborhood by neighborhood, to see what they are interested in, and even pick, and even if the neighborhood self-selects that they would want this, we could not adopt it citywide, but where it's wanted. And that's the approach
we're
looking at.
What's the geography of a neighborhood? Like, would it be all of Lake Hills, or would it be like Spiritwood, which is a subset of Lake Hills? Because I could see it being very different in the smaller neighborhoods.
And I think that would
thank you.
The work would be done with through the neighborhood area planning program, which would cover the larger area
I think
you're talking
13
about.
13 to 16 or something.
16, I think. 16,
yeah.
But in doing that process, if we find there are certain areas that it's supported and others where it's not, it could be applied a little more surgically. Yeah, thank you. That's the word I was looking for. It could be set up that way as well.
I think what we're looking at is we did tree retention programs in this way, where we didn't do it citywide, but we looked at applying it to neighborhoods that were interested in that, because it very, very much
across
the city.
Does current zoning, when you say micro apartments, basically we're talking about dormitories, right?
No, because
small living units with common areas. Right?
Well, these could be self-contained.
Yeah, okay. They often have their own kitchen, but it's a limited kitchen, so they can do the cooking in there, but there may be a common...
It's like a studio?
...kitchen area as well. It's smaller than a studio. Yeah, it can be it's usually less than 400 square feet.
Yeah. No, I lived in one during college. Mm-hmm. What's the current zoning around light rail?
Well, you can do micro apartments
that's
in Bellevue in any area that's zoned. Well, economically, you could do it where it's zoned for floor area ratio rather than dwelling units per acre.
So basically, that's downtown in Bell Red right now.
Right.
But the trigger to that is the parking.
Yeah. We're not going to see anything. We've heard from developers at the parking ratios that are required now.
Just one second. If you like, you can, while you're talking, you can use your tablet, go in and search for images of micro apartments, which I just did.
I don't have Google on mine.
You have Safari, though, which is the Apple version.
Because I tried that way earlier before I had Google Maps.
I have a
couple
points
of clarity.
Okay.
The micro apartments in here in the packet that I read, they're proposing it going down to 220 square feet. So you just said 400, so I just want to
less than 400.
Frame of reference is 220. And then the TOD now, and the, I don't know if it will be two, but NMU are talking in terms of floor area ratio.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be Eastgate 2.
Downtown
in Bellwood, but once Eastgate is adopted, it will be in Eastgate as well.
But we're probably going to be looking at the quarter mile around the light rail stations as kind of areas that this would be appropriate for when we set up our screening.
So that would not apply in Eastgate right now because it's not a light rail station. Unless we extend it to that. So, yes, it's a possibility, but what we had in mind is really around the light rail stations. That's where it makes the most sense right now. Now, in the future, when we have a light rail station out in Eastgate, that could work as well. But where the demand is going to be, what we're anticipating, is really where the light rail is coming in the near future.
So we'll give it to you, Ann.
I've got two. Thank you, John.
Oh, I'm still on this one? Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I think maybe I had interrupted you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, that's fine. Two questions. The first one is with the micro apartment. There's a trend across the nation with tiny houses. Is it because of parking that you're limiting this micro apartments to near light rail? Why not open it citywide or wherever it makes sense. So why limiting it only to light rail? And the second question that I have is, in terms of variety of housing, as you stated, our demographic is changing. As part of that conversation, did you consider multi-generational housing as an option?
That certainly is something I should have mentioned, you know, when I said that we don't reflect our, you know, we don't have enough variety in housing. You know, we've got more than half of our households of one- or two-person households. But we also have needs for housings for multi-generation families and, you know, all the diversity that we have in Bellevue. So that would be certainly another thing that we have to consider. And families like that that need affordable housing. A lot of times when we do our affordable housing funding, we give extra points to projects that have three or more bedrooms because they're especially in short demand for lower-income families that are larger and have children or multi-generations.
Well, I think it may even go further than that. If you take, for example, the Indian families moving mm-hmm. into the area, usually there's three generations living together and mm-hmm. they need a larger home. I mean, I've seen a home in Lakemont, essentially was three homes in one. I mean, it was 6,000 square feet. It was huge. But they had their own kitchen for each wing of mm-hmm. the home. Does the current zoning allow that somewhere citywide? Or
would that be the accessory dwelling?
It's different because that's detached.
Yeah, well, we have attached.
Yeah, that's the idea of a mother-in-law apartment. If you had a separate unit that a family member was living in, that would be allowed in any residential zone.
We don't regulate the number of related persons living in a home.
And that's true.
Well,
so that's something that can be done, and that's really not in the affordable range. You know, when you're talking about a 6,000-square-foot house.
I hear you, Mike. However, I remember prior to my joining the commission, there was an effort put together towards a definition of a family. And if you have multi-generation, I think that may be different from the city's definition of family.
No, we covered that. We covered the multi-generation family. It has to do with being related versus
number of unrelated persons mm-hmm. living in a That we regulate. We don't regulate related persons.
Okay.
Yeah, and then to answer your first question about just around light rail stations, that's the focus of this mm-hmm. Because the research that we've done, we've looked at what's done in other parts of the country and where those work and where they don't, but we've heard from the development community. The key to it is really the reduced parking mm-hmm. as well, because the folks that want to live in those, it's getting at that a lot of folks that are just entering the workforce. They don't need a lot of space. They don't have a lot of stuff. They don't necessarily have a car. So they really need to be close to transit, to mm-hmm. good transit. And the light rail offers the best mm-hmm. form of that. You know, that's one reason that they were so popular in Capitol Hill, for example, because of the transit availability there. So it doesn't necessarily make sense to have that type of housing in areas that don't have the same level of transit service.
And they'll have a negative impact of spillover parking. Because if the members of the micro apartments all have cars mm-hmm. and there's not a lot of cars parking provided.
Yeah, but what experience has shown in other places is that they typically don't have the same number of cars. The people that live in those micro apartments. If they've got the transit available, they don't need the car and they don't need the expense. That's something I should have mentioned earlier, too. Transportation, housing is the largest single expense in a household budget. That's one reason it's set at 30%. The second largest expenditure is transportation.
Yeah.
And a single automobile is the biggest piece of that. So if you can provide housing that doesn't require the automobile, you've made that house more affordable or that home more affordable.
I imagine you could increase the radius distance from a transit station these days with like Uber and Lyft, right? So it's still
that last mile isn't as hard to get to.
Yeah.
Well, and Janet mentioned a quarter mile, and that's that's that first ring that's really mm-hmm. the most intense, and then half mile is as far as folks will generally walk to a light rail station.
Yeah.
Just a quick time check. It's about 6 minutes, I think, to go for your time slot.
Oops,
so if you wouldn't mind.
I'm talking faster here.
We've got three more strategies to go
through. I do.
Thank you.
Hey, C, create more affordable housing. Sounds obvious. one of the things that we've heard from our housing partners, nonprofits that like Dash and Housing, it's very hard for them to operate in Bellevue because of the land prices. So action C1 is looking at some options where we might be able to acquire land in Bellevue at less than market rates, increasing development potential. So we'd be looking at potential properties that were appropriate for housing and affordable housing that right now is either public surplus land owned by faith-based communities or owned by nonprofits. Now, one of the best opportunities that we have probably coming up for affordable housing is developing housing on Sound Transit surplus construction staging sites down at, in Bell Red at 130th and in Bell Red at the station.
OMFE,
thank you. We'll be looking at certainly opportunities like that with Sound Transit or City or other public agencies. Faith-based, of course, we've had some properties that have been, like, such as the one in the picture at St. Margaret's Church, that's Andrews Glen, and looking for other faith-based properties that might be appropriate for affordable housing, and looking at nonprofits. And the reason why this might come back to you is that if they were appropriate to even increase the density on the existing density for redevelopment, just like St. Margaret's came to you for the rezone. Mm-hmm. And then council has shown interest in incentive zoning, or zoning incentives, where you would get extra density for providing affordable units, such as the program that's been successful in Bell Red, and extending that. Now, right now, that's being considered in downtown with those code changes and in Eastgate. And then we'll be looking at Wilburton area in the next year and past that in the East Main. And then reducing development costs. Now, that certain action looks at for affordable housing. And that might be, because it's always, we always hear about the parking, but there may be things that we do specifically for affordable housing developers, like deferring when they have to pay their impact fees so it's more aligned with their funding, or when they pay their street improvements. So things like that, that we could help affordable housing developers reduce their costs and time.
Yeah. As part of your research, it kind of gets to this inclusionary zoning. There's a lot of talk about what the right ratio is.
Mm.
Did you all come across any? I know it's probably based on each neighborhood.
It is pretty much
really
based, because you have to, what you're trying to do is get that incentive so that the on the voluntary program, so that the developer it fills their gap and gives them some extra so that they have the incentive to do it without being at without being a large giveaway, because then you have to increase your density so much.
Yeah.
And so not only do you have to kind of hit that sweet spot, but you have to keep checking it, making sure it's right. Although it looks like I've got the same action here, this strategy is looking at the overall housing market, not just the affordable housing market, and how can we reduce the cost of development and the time of development so that we can get more housing stock in Bellevue to reduce that pressure that we are feeling right now because there's such a scarcity of housing stock. Not only are we, everyone knows about the single family bids, I mean, even apartments are being bid up because of the scarcity of stock right now.
Janet, I was looking at that and reading it, and forgive me, but I was laughing because there's no land in Bellevue. Last I read, we only had 900 acres of vacant land. So how are we going to do that unless we change the zoning?
Well, that's the city's toolbox, is regulation and zoning.
And keep in mind, we have a lot of capacity in the city still. I mean, even though there's not a lot of vacant land in Bellevue and we're not going to grow any bigger in terms of land area, there's a lot of capacity in the land that we have.
Say more about that.
Well, as you've seen, you know, the 900 acres of Bell Red that we rezoned for mixed use, we've taken land out of commercial and industrial use and put it into housing and retail office use. So that creates more capacity for housing. we're looking at Wilburton for that,
mm-hmm.
and we're adding capacity for mixed use, including housing in Eastgate. So these are ways that we're kind of changing land use, which isn't vacant, but it's changing it to make more housing capacity.
Mm-hmm. What were the ideas around reducing development costs? How
for that, well, let's see. Housing, parking comes up a lot.
Yeah.
Also, we're looking at types of housing construction, whether we can use more prefab or modular construction, or any ways that we can use more wood frame construction, which is a less expensive construction type over steel frame. Those are the kinds of things that we've heard from developers that might be able to be put into our code to reduce construction costs.
That was my concern, that we would be cheapening the units. Right, to some extent, in terms of materials?
No,
not necessarily.
It's evolving technology.
Yeah, that's
okay.
That's a better way of saying it.
Yeah.
It's fascinating because there is a lot of evolving technologies and materials for building that can allow building at a, like, for example, with wood at higher heights than ever thought of before.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that fascinates me is that this autonomous vehicles and self-driving vehicles and the next generation, having the vehicle ownership like the older generations do. And so, you know, a future where perhaps you just get on your phone and you call up the autonomous car that comes to pick you up, no need to own the car anymore.
Yeah.
You're like the zip cars, you're kind of leasing them.
Yeah, I mentioned that when we were talking about distance from the transit station, right?
Yeah.
That you can have
right.
micro units
right
now because now you have Uber, Lyft, and
yeah, but where it's heading is that there's a lot of it's almost a brand new world in terms of how information technology is changing.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing is we've got to address the issue of property taxes and what that lays on in terms of housing costs,
mm-hmm.
you know, as well. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, Bellevue makes much of the fact that it has one of the lowest property tax rates in King County. Well, your rate is low because your property values keep skyrocketing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, has anyone really looked at how property tax, particularly for seniors on fixed incomes who don't meet the threshold of low income,
right?
How much is costing them to stay in their own home?
And that's one of the reasons we're looking at things like the accessory dwelling units and all the research that we've looked at. And I know it's not popular everywhere, but that's one way that seniors can stay in their homes. It gives them another source of income by having that accessory dwelling
mm-hmm.
unit. They can either live in the unit and rent out the house, or they can use the income from the rental unit to live in there. That's just one example. Another thing that we heard through some of the focus groups that we did, getting specifically at the senior exemption for property tax, is that the exemption level has not been raised in like 20 years,
right.
if I understand that correctly. So it's really taking a look at that, and that's something that can happen at the I don't know if the county can do that on their own, if they have to have legislation to do that.
Mm.
But those are that's one of the other things that we've also looked at.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a point that I want to make. I think that's a really dangerous premise where the city would really have to help seniors with what it means to have a tenant in their backyard. They'd need help with the laws. They'd need help with collecting rent.
Mm-hmm.
They might need a separate law in terms of evictions. They would need help. They might need property management help.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't, being a landlord is not for the faint of heart. It's hard. And so the notion that somebody can make money, you can make it sound all nice and sweet, but unless all those support factors are there, I think it's really unfair to say you can pay your taxes by housing somebody in your backyard. I think there's just so many other moving parts to that
mm-hmm.
with unintended consequences that it has to completely be thought through and not sold with
only the benefit. There has to be the downside of it.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good point. And none of these are simple solutions either, just like they're not simple issues that we're trying to deal with. Mm-hmm. We've also looked at what other cities have done, and they've been able to address those things. And, mm-hmm. and there are ways to make those work. But you're right. There's a lot more to it.
There's also cities where it's gone really badly. Mm-hmm. And homeowners have wound up physically hurt or pushed from their homes. Mm-hmm. So we gotta really research the downside of it.
And we can learn from all of those things.
I just want to point out this D3 because it's interesting and it might come to Planning Commission when we look at code changes. But we heard from the development community that the measuring density and floor area ratio gives them a lot more flexibility to respond to markets, whether they want larger units or mixed units or a mixture of sizes or uses within the building, because all you're dealing with is that building envelope, not how you break it up. And they thought that we might look at, in some of our like R30 zones, that we could expand to a floor area ratio instead. Mm. So they'd have that added flexibility.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Thank you.
Almost done.
Almost done. No more highlighted ones either. And this one, of course, as Michael said on the longer sheet that gave the little symbols for the money, a lot of the ones that I've been talking about, like preservation and acquiring existing properties, are going to take some extra funding. And so we have some actions here that we might look at for both local funding sources, which council would be looking at through the two-year budget process, or looking at advocating for additional tools from the state legislature, or advocating the state legislature for additional monies through the State Housing Trust Fund. And we also found in this process that we're going to need other funding, other partnerships, and maybe bring in other funders, like working with employers. And lessons learned. Let's see. The intent was for us to turn over every stone looking for new tools. Some of the things that we found was that we looked at how other communities were looking tools, using tools, and how we were using tools. But there really is a limited suite of tools out there to increase affordable housing. It might just be that we really need to double down on what we're doing and learn how to do this, how to do better with what with the tools that are out there. We're going to need more local partners in this effort, including, like I mentioned, working with the development community, working with employers, faith-based and nonprofit providers, and looking at regional partners. Bellevue is very good at that. We were one of the founding members of ARCH 25 years ago. We've got some good opportunities in the pipeline, working with Sound Transit on some of their surplus properties. And King County Housing Authority is anxious to work with us on preservation efforts in our community. And as Michael mentioned, that we just started up with this King County Regional Affordable Housing Task Force, which Mayor Stokes is on, which we hope can help us not only look at tools that we can do regionally, but funding sources that might be out there. We're going to do a council check-in with our implementation program, talking about timing and the partners and departments that will be working on these different strategies. The first things that we are proposing that we start on in 2017, and this is because council was very interested in these, was updating the multifamily tax exemption so that more developers will take part in that. City of Seattle's had a lot of success with getting affordable units by offering this 12-year exemption from taxes paid on the residential new development. Doing the rezone analysis, that just means that we would start looking at for the land that we're trying to get that might be available from nonprofits, faith-based, public surplus, start doing analysis and what criteria might make those properties suitable. And then the things that are also on the jumpstart are things that we're already working on, like the code updates for voluntary affordable housing incentives in downtown and Eastgate. And then, of course, we'll be looking at Wilburton and East Main next time. Also, for our first phase, we're going to be developing community and stakeholder rich outreach for these different strategies and setting up a monitoring program, as Michael said, so that we can get feedback regularly on what's working, what's not, so we can adjust and we can make regular reports to council.
What do you have planned for community and stakeholder outreach?
We looked at, we're trying to put our different types of strategies into buckets and looking at specific ways for each one. Some of them will be working very much at the neighborhood level, like the floor area ratio one, where the neighbors that might be impacted, we'd be working with them. And then other ones, like our legislative outreach and such, we'll be doing more community-wide information. So we'll definitely be getting specific to what's needed and what level of outreach we need for each one of these. Did I do that? I did that.
You got it. You're there.
Thank you. I'm done.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
I didn't know it was black. Sorry about that.
So thank you. That was very good.
Okay. Thank you.
I have one last comment.
Yes.
In terms of outreach, so neighborhood versus, I get that level.
Yeah.
But across SES levels as well? So across different income levels?
Oh, yeah.
In terms of
We always try to reach out to people that, are living in affordable housing, the housing providers, especially the people that are going to be impacted. And we have really good advocates in Bellevue Network on aging with the issues with seniors, and we love working with them. They're really good, bringing a lot of good input. We know from them that a lot of seniors want to remain in their homes, and the supports that are available that we can increase to make that happen. That's most always the most affordable housing that they can have, is to be able to not be pushed out of their homes. And that's really important. That's something that's a key focus of a lot of these issues.
So is the homeless population a part of the affordable housing study, so transition housing, and do you plan to talk to them as well?
That was not part of the study because that was really going on its own track.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we did talk in the report about the relationship, because a lot of there's a good portion of the affordable issue that is related to the the homelessness problem.
Evictions,
and like I said, the folks that are paying more than 50% of their income, those are the ones that often move into homelessness.
Right.
For some period, hopefully not for too long. But the best solution to homelessness is to prevent it from happening in the first place. So anything we can do to keep folks in their home is better. So we didn't come up with strategies to address that, but we did talk about the relationship.
Okay. Is it possible for us to have the electronic version of your presentation, please?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
We'll send it out.
Mm-hmm.
There was a
technical
issue today because we sent it out in PowerPoint and don't have it.
Thank you. Thanks for your time and all the good comments. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Moving on, I believe we have 1 draft minute to review.
Can I bring up one thing in other business? I don't know if anybody else is curious, but I'm curious about.
You sure?
I need Terry.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I'm just curious where we are on the commissioner selection.
We received the commissioner recruitment notice closed, I believe it was June 22nd or 23rd, and the clerk's office received 17 applications, and those applications are now with the mayor. And the mayor is, my understanding is, there's no established written down protocol, but my understanding is what they do is that the mayor will choose so many of those to be interviewed and then make a recommendation to council. He hasn't gotten back to me yet about what his selection is of the people that he wants to have interviewed. I've reminded him a couple of times, that we're ready when he's able to, and that's where we are with it. So I don't know what the timing is for when we'll have a new commissioner seated.
Is the interview process going to change from what we all went through?
I'm not familiar with what...
So the interview process that I went through, and I believe John went through, was a team interview. Mm-hmm. So it was Paul Ingram, and it was the chair of the commission.
And the chair of the commission.
There was a council member. There were more people in the room, and I'm
trying
to think.
Yeah, there were two council members of mine.
You had how many?
Two. Yeah, the staff person, the council liaison, the chair of the commission, and sometimes another member of the council will sit in.
Okay. So is that how we're going to do it, or is it?
I to be honest with you, I don't know. I would guess that it probably would be the same way, that there's no reason to do it differently. I talked with Emil about what the past practice has been, and when I sit down with the mayor, I will ask him also what his preferences are and then remind him of what the past practice has been. So I would assume that he'd want to follow something similar. But that I don't know. I don't know what discretion he might have in determining what that interview panel would look like.
Thank you.
Thank you. So moving on then, we have one draft minutes to review. I believe it's the 14th of June.
Correct.
So any comments, any questions, or if not, a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
There we go. Public comment. I believe we have no public comment. We will just keep moving on. Do we have a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
We have second?
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
There we go.
And I wish everyone a wonderful and safe summer break.
Thank you. And you too.
And yes.
And please let Aaron Lang know that his recharging cords